Hello, I'm Andrew Kleiman. This is episode 114 of Radio Free Humanity, the Marxist Humanist Podcast. We're coming to you from deep within capitalist society. In the main segment of this episode, Teresa Henry joins Gabriel Donnelly and me to discuss the political situation in Canada. Among other things, we talk about Pierre Poilievre, and the dominance of white nationalism on the right in Canada, the so-called Freedom Convoy and its relation to Trumpism in the U.S., as well as struggles for the rights and sovereignty of Indigenous nations. We recorded that interview on March 24. But before that, we've got this episode's current events segment. That was recorded on March 31. Gabriel and I discuss Ronna McDaniel, the former head of the Republican National Committee, who NBC hired as a commentator. But after blowback from prominent NBC News staffers, McDaniel was Ronna out of town. Please visit MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, the website of Marxist Humanist Initiative. To listen to past episodes of this podcast series, to learn more about the issues discussed in them, to post comments, and to donate to the podcast series. We really do need donations. Radio Free Humanity is sponsored and hosted by Marxist Humanist Initiative, but the views expressed by hosts and guests are our own. They don't necessarily reflect the views or positions of MHI. I'd like to announce that on Sunday, April 7, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time in the U.S., 6 to 8 p.m. British Summer Time, MHI will be holding a Zoom meeting on the state of the U.K. economy in the year of the general elections, with a presentation by Ralph Keller. And on Sunday, April 21, in the same time slot, MHI will hold a Zoom meeting that I'll be leading on interpretation. Both meetings are open to the public. If you'd like to attend, please write to MHI and ask to be invited and tell us briefly about your interest in MHI. To attend the April 7 meeting, you'll have to act quickly. Next up will be Gabriel and I discussing the Ronna McDaniel hiring and firing.
Hello, this is Gabriel Donnelly. I'm here with Andrew Kleiman. It's March 31st, 2024, as we record this current event segment. And we're talking today about Ronna McDaniel. She's the former head of the Republican National Committee. And she was recently hired by NBC. And after some protesting on behalf of MSNBC news hosts and staff, she was very publicly fired, and it's a big news story. And Andrew, I'm wondering if you can give us some background on this.
Stephen Colbert, the comedian, kind of summed it up pretty well. He says, she's a morally bankrupt, dictator-enabling douche nugget. So I thought that was right. Morally bankrupt, dictator-enabling, and douche nugget. She's a niece of Mitt Romney, who was a Republican candidate for president, but Mitt Romney and Trump were on the outs, and she basically went all in with Trump. He wanted her to dissociate herself from Mitt Romney, even by changing her name, because she used to be Ronna Romney McDaniel, and she said, okay. So she then became Ronna McDaniel. In addition, she was part of the big lie, the stolen election conspiracy. She was on a call where people needed to certify the election. She's on the phone with them, and Trump's on the phone with them, and she says, absolutely do not sign any papers. We'll get you a lawyer. So she was helping to prevent the duly elected incoming president from taking office. But more recently, what happened is Trump wanted his own people directly under his command to be running the Republican National Committee. He managed to take over the RNC, push her out. She managed to line up NBC. They hire her. And then basically everything hits the fan pretty quickly. That was announced Friday, 9 days ago, that she was going to join as a commentator on Sunday on Meet the Press, which is on NBC, Sunday morning. The host, Kristen Welker, does an interview with her, absolutely rakes her over the coals. And then the former host, Chuck Todd, says, you know, the people who run this network should really apologize to you, Kristen, for putting you in this position. This is absolutely horrible. On Monday, everybody, all the show hosts at MSNBC, denounced the idea that this person would be allowed to be a political commentator. You had Joe Scarborough, Mika Brzezinski, you've got Jen Psaki, you got Rachel Maddow, did a half an hour basically saying fascists have always been in the United States. They were a big deal in the 30s, but they weren't able to take power because they didn't have a major party behind them. Trump does. And then she went into stuff about Ronna McDaniel. The point was, this woman is enabling what will be a fascist dictatorship. Lawrence O'Donnell, another host, absolutely denounced this. Basically, they were just denouncing their own bosses.
You just mentioned the basic half hour that Maddow did in saying that this enables fascism, but this wasn't the only reason for opposing her appointment. There were other reasons why not to have her on.
Chuck Todd's saying, we've been gaslit by the Trumpites for a very, very long time. McDaniel is not turning on them. She's still defending him in many ways. She now says Biden won fair and square, but she didn't say that for the longest time. She now says, well, I don't believe that the election was stolen. Well, why'd you say it when you were chair of the RNC? Oh, well, you know, I'm a team player. Sometimes you take one for the team. So Chuck Todd's saying, our job is to tell the truth as journalists. And when she says something, we don't even know what she believes to be the truth and what she doesn't believe to be the truth. He was kind of saying it's not about politics. Rachel Maddow was saying it's about politics, Democrats versus Republicans, but liberal democracy versus. It was really significant that you had such concerted pushback from the staff, where they're criticizing not only McDaniel, they're criticizing their bosses. What NBC was trying to do, obviously, is to do the both sides of the thing. And you would think that after everything we've seen with Trumpism in the last 8-9 years, that the news organizations, the bosses, would understand the dangers of them promoting and continuing to promote both sides as journalism. But it's still going on. Why is NBC News at this moment in history, where the fate of liberal democracy hangs in the balance against a fascist dictatorship, why do they still pursue this both sidesist model of journalism? Have they not learned? Something that Josh Marshall has been talking about, I think he's got a very good point. He says it's not that they don't understand. This is the business model. Journalism is in such a precarious position that the only way to survive is to capture the center of the market, because advertisers don't want to advertise to little niches. You have to have a lot of viewers, and the way to do that is you have to play the both sides this game. You know, in capitalist society, you're a capitalist business. So what he's saying is the laws of profit making make it impossible that the mainstream news media are ever going to change.
I've just been wondering through this whole kerfuffle, why hire her? Especially since they get this immediate pushback. She's not a huge name. You're not getting a huge draw. You're not appeasing to the Democrats and the liberals that tune in, right? We know that regular anti-Trump Republicans aren't going to love her because she's a Trump collaborationist and election denier. And she just got canned by Trump. So you're not getting MAGA people to tune in. So why bother? Why hire her, right?
Certain people were saying, well, what NBC was doing was to signal to the Trump world that, okay, if Trump comes back into power and does his Putin Orban destruction of the independent media, that they would be willing to go along and have Trump state controlled media at NBC just to toe the line. The question is, well, if McDaniel is on the outs with Trump, how does hiring McDaniel signal to the Trump world people that we're going to capitulate? If you want to take over the news media, you don't have to shoot us. You don't have to poison us. You don't have to jail us. You don't have to run us out of the country. We'll do what you say. Even though she's on the outs with Trump, I still think that that's the kind of signal that it does send. If Trump takes power again, that they're going to do what they're told because they're afraid. I don't know that for a fact, but it seems reasonable to me.
I don't think that's unreasonable at all. Do you remember the Red Hen restaurant incident?
Oh, yeah, that was somewhere in Virginia, right?
So, yeah, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, went in to eat, and the chef called the owner and said, "Hey, just so you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is eating here." The owner came to the restaurant and kind of did a straw poll of the staff there and said, "Who wants to serve this woman and have her eat here?" And nobody who worked there did. Everybody said, "We don't want her here. We don't want to serve her food." And so the owner went out and told her, "You got to go. Nobody wants to serve you." And I thought about that incident a lot because we have power in our own little ways to say no to these people when they try to come in or they try to act like they're normal or what they do is normal or what they're part of is normal. We, at the very least, can always say, "No, it's not, and we want nothing to do with you."
I think that's important. If you're Chuck Todd, if you're Rachel Maddow, it's a lot easier for you to take a half an hour of airtime and denounce not only Ronald McDaniel and American fascism, but your own bosses. It's harder if you're a restaurant staff person, but there are ways of resisting for sure. This episode's main segment will be coming up in just a few minutes, but first, a word from our sponsoring organization, Marxist Humanist Initiative. Here is the organizational secretary of MHI, Anne Jaclard, talking about who we are.
This is Anne Jaclard from Marxist Humanist Initiative, or MHI. MHI aims to contribute to the transformation of this capitalist world by projecting, developing, and concretizing the philosophy of Karl Marx and its further development in the Marxist humanism articulated by Raya Dunayevskaya. Today, amidst many wars, climate crises, economic, social, and political crises, is a moment to engage people in discussion of these ideas. In the US, we're faced with the threat of Trumpism triumphing in all-out authoritarianism, extinguishing our right even to carry on such discussions. MHI is dedicated to the task of proving theoretically that an alternative to capitalism is possible. We are distinguished by our economic analyses, in which we do not merely assert but demonstrate that the only opposite to the current world economic system is its abolition and replacement with one not based on the production of, quote, value, close quote. Because capitalism cannot be fundamentally reformed, attempts to reform it lead to an intensification of state capitalism and not to socialism. We are not a political party, nor are we trying to lead the masses who will form their own organizations and whose emancipation must be their own act. But we have seen that spontaneous actions alone are insufficient to usher in a new society. We seek a new unity of philosophy and organization in which mass movements striving for freedom lay hold of Marx's philosophy of revolution and recreate society on its basis. Our ideas and actions, as well as our structure and rules, are guarded by the interests of working people and freedom movements of people of color, LGBTQ people, other minorities, women, youth, and all those around the world who are struggling for self-determination in order to freely develop their own human natures. We have no interests separate and apart from theirs. To this end, we open our website and podcast to the widest possible dialogue with people around the world. We intend to practice as well as to espouse a two-way road between our organization and people outside it as essential to developing a single dialectic in the relationship of theory to practice and as a way to assure the survival of Marxist humanism. Our collective is working to create an organization so firmly rooted in its philosophy that it will not succumb to diversions that may arise from personal agendas, and that will be capable of developing and concretizing the philosophy over the long haul, regardless of who its members may be. It is no simple matter to create a democratic organization that is at the same time effective and able to resist efforts to divert it from its goals. We are aware that Marx never achieved an organization based on his philosophy, and that Dostoevskaya's organization disintegrated following her death. But we have made progress in this matter with our principles and bylaws, and by recognizing that Marxist humanism cannot be carried on by chance or by individuals alone. An organization is needed in order to test and prove ideas. We invite all of you to join us in this discussion and our initiative.
That was Andrew Clard, the Organizational Secretary of Marxist Humanist Initiative, the organization that sponsors this podcast series, talking about who we are. Next up, the episode's main segment.
Hello, I am regular co-host Gabriel Donnelly here. We're recording on March the 24th. I'm here with regular co-host Andrew Kleiman.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. And today we're here with our special guest, Teresa Henry, who you've heard many times on the show before, most recently discussing the Russian revision of the Law of Value with Andrew, and previously discussing the women's revolt in Iran. But on today's episode, we'll be talking about the threat of Trumpism in Canada. How are we today, Teresa?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you on. We wanted to discuss the threat of Trumpism in Canada because the threat of Trumpism in America is a frequent topic on the show, both in the main segments and on the current events. But, you know, Canadian politics have always seemed to Americans as a more mellow, easygoing compared to American politics, but the recent Freedom Convoy, I think, disrupted that vision for a lot of people. So I think we should start there, but establishing what the Freedom Convoy was.
And why did this Freedom Convoy take place?
So nominally, the Freedom Convoy was about protesting vaccine mandates, specifically vaccine mandates for truckers going over the border. But I say nominally this is why it happened, because it doesn't really add up. Because at the time of the Freedom Convoy, 85 to 90% of the truckers who would go over the border, the US-Canada border, were already vaccinated. So having a protest against having to get vaccinated after being vaccinated doesn't really seem logical. I think the real reason why the convoy happened, there's groups of white nationalist figures who wanted to take the opportunity to challenge the Canadian government in a point in time when a big blow had been dealt to their legitimacy over perceived mishandling of the pandemic. So the Freedom Convoy was started on January 22nd, 2022, and there was hundreds of vehicles that drove across the country, starting in different provinces, to converge on Parliament in Ottawa with a rally at Parliament Hill. And the Freedom Convoy has been associated with long-haul truckers And certainly there was some long haul truckers in the Freedom Convoy, but it wasn't just truckers. And I would like to make the clarification that the Freedom Convoy was not a progressive movement for freedom in any universal sense. And it also was not a mass working class movement. For example, while it was happening, or shortly after, the Ontario Federation of Labor released a statement on the Freedom Convoy titled simply, "This is not a workers' movement." And the statement describes how the convoyers harassed and bullied Ontario workers, how the protests negatively impacted steel workers and auto workers and service workers. And the Federation of Labor in Ontario, they described the convoy as led by white supremacists who, quote, have spread Islamophobic, anti-Semitic, and racist hate on social media and elsewhere.
I have a personal connection to freedom trucker rhetoric because it's something that drives my father nuts. He's a long-haul trucker, and there's some of it now in America. They kind of pick this up. And here in America, it's used by people who just have big personal use trucks, and they'll put, you know, I'm a freedom trucker because I have a big truck with a big truck bed, but they're not long haul truckers. Was there that kind of culture of well-to-do upper middle class white people who have, you know, big pickup trucks describing themselves as truckers to sort of steal working class authenticity for this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know the particular, I can only judge the people's class backgrounds from their appearances, but there definitely it wasn't just long haul truckers. And I don't know what the composition exactly was, but there was lots of like SUVs, and there was rumors about construction bosses and transportation logistics bosses renting trucks for people and buying trucks to drive themselves and stuff to make it look more authentic. And certainly there was people driving around the city with the stickers and stuff on their cars that had nothing to do with the trucking industry. But I think there's definitely this like middle class or upper middle class use of the imagery, but I also don't think that it was totally it had some resonance amongst workers too. Like one of my good friends is an electrician. They live pretty good compared to other workers. My friend was telling me that on the construction sites and stuff like that, people were talking sympathetically about the Freedom Convoy and had Trump stickers and Freedom Convoy stickers and stuff like that. And I work in the restaurant industry, and there was people in the kitchens that were talking about how the Freedom Convoy was a good thing too. And these are people that make like really, really bad wages and don't live like the upper crust of the professional workers in Canada. So I think there was all classes, but I don't think it can be constituted as a working class movement. It wasn't actually like a trucker specific movement against the vaccine mandates. It was a big kind of mess of white supremacist and white nationalist and reactionary views on display, and all sorts of people jumping in to be part of the action. But and also the organizers of it, though, were not truckers. Like the well-funded and notable organizers of it are not truckers. So I'll list a couple of those people. Tamara Lick, she belongs to a movement whose founder advocated of the secession of Alberta into the Trump-led United States. There's Patrick King, who's another Western separatist and anti-immigrant activist. There's James Botter and Romana Didillo, who are QAnon conspiracy theorists. Action for Canada was part of it. They're an Islamophobic and anti-LGBTQ group. Jason LaFace, a prominent Canadian anti-vaxxer. Benjamin Ditcher, Canadian Islamophobe. And then there was people, a part of the a convoy who had ties to Soldiers of Odin, which is a neo-Nazi gang, and a Dia Golan, which is like a far-right accelerationist paramilitary group.
And so these people were like a pre-existing network of white nationalists and separatists and stuff, and they saw COVID and the dissatisfaction regarding COVID and policies as a way to increase their reach and their public presence. So they decided to exploit the issue. Yeah.
I think so. There was a lot of popular resentment around the miss between around how Canada responded to the pandemic. There was confusing information. There was the way that the restrictions were rolled out, bothered people. People lost their jobs. There was the anti-vaxxer people who were all upset about having to get vaccinated. And then there was the people who were upset that they had to wear masks because apparently they don't have any common decency.
Right. What is the extent to which there's this pre-existing white supremacist and authoritarian sentiment within Canada, like we have in the US?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a big thing to talk about and to not underestimate, is the existence of and the role of white nationalism and authoritarianism in Canadian politics more broadly and historically. Like, you guys say that Americans think that Canadian politics is more mellow than American politics. I think there's another myth about Canada too that has to be dispelled, and it's this myth that Canada is less racist than the United States because we didn't have slaves, which we did, but just not on the same scale, or that Canada treated its indigenous population better. But none of this is true. So I want to quote something quick from the National Inquiry on the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women.
Okay, so this was a national inquiry set up by the government of Canada, and they brought in members of families who had been affected to advise.
The violence the National Inquiry heard about amounts to a race-based genocide of Indigenous peoples, including First Nations, Inuit, and Métis, which especially targets women, girls, and LGBTQ people and Two-Spirit people. This genocide has been empowered by colonial structures, evidenced notably by the Indian Act, the 60s Scoop, residential schools, and breaches of human and Indigenous rights, leading directly to the current increased rates of violence, death, and suicide in Indigenous populations, end quote. So this national inquiry came out a couple years ago. This problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people is not like some problem that happened around settlement. Like, it's this ongoing current problem. I don't think that white nationalism, especially anti-Indigenous racism in Canada, but on the West Coast where I live, also especially anti-Chinese racism, xenophobia, which increased, it was like an observable increase in attacks and harassment of Chinese people during the pandemic. These things are core to Canada and have always been. Systematic murder and disappearance of Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people is not some distant phenomenon. It's an ongoing problem that shows that anti-Indigenous racism and white nationalist views are still core to Canadian society and politics. Because there's definitely, the inquiry points out these structural state violences like the Indian Act, 60s Scoop, residential schools.
60s Scoop. And what is that?
Yeah. So this is in the 1960s. There was policies enacted that enabled welfare authorities like Child and Family Services to take Indigenous children from their families, steal Indigenous children from their families and place them in white foster care families. And this was an attempt alongside the residential schools to annihilate Indigenous culture and family ties and kinship relations.
And this was called a scoop because they scooped up these kids from their families and moved them elsewhere into boarding schools or something. Yeah.
Into the residential schools, yes, but also into the foster care system where they would get adopted by white families and be raised with like a Anglo or white cultural value.
And it was called a scoop because they were scooping up kids?
Yeah. But also, it's not just state violence. Like, there's a vigilante violence against Indigenous people. For example, the Search the Landfill campaign, which is happening in Winnipeg right now, there's two protest camps set up by the families and loved ones of women who were murdered by this white serial killer vigilante, and the remains are they're pressuring the government, the provincial and the federal government and the police force, to search the landfill for the bodies so they can have their loved ones' bodies returned to them.
One aspect of the, you know, whole resurgence of white supremacism in the U.S., the Trumpism, is this feeling that, like, we, the real Americans, we are losing our country. It's being taken over not only by the immigrants, the non-whites, it's being taken over by the liberals and the cosmopolitans, and of course, you know, Jews is what cosmopolitans means. Is there that kind of sentiment in the far right in Canada?
Yeah, definitely. There's this idea that, I mean, I've interacted with this outside of the organized far right. There's this idea that Canada is becoming less white. So I at work, when I lived in a smaller town, one of my coworkers said to me, I got to move out of this town to the neighboring town. There's not enough white people here. And when I've been in the past years doing activism in Vancouver with low-income people, people living on the streets and stuff like that, there is this idea amongst some people, some white people, that there's too many immigrants, that they don't have housing because it's all taken up by non-white immigrants. There's this big myth about foreign investment that, like, there's people can't find housing and housing is unaffordable because of Chinese real estate developers. And I've talked to even people in the queer community who said that they feel like a minority in their own country.
Not because they're queer, but because they're white.
Yes, because they're white. It's entered even into the queer community that you would think is generally, well, is more left-leaning and more tolerant of difference. Even in these circles, they're saying that they feel like a minority in their own country, which signals that Canada is a white country, not a multicultural country, that the multiculturalism is some undesirable new thing. But it's true that there is racial diversity here, especially in the urban centers. The consequence is this, is that Canadian national identity is becoming more expansive and composite and less associated with being Anglo or being white. And this challenges and threatens people. And I'd also like to say that this has been happening for a long time. So we see the Freedom Convoy and it looks really extreme. But these white nationalist groups and these right-wing people have been saying this stuff for decades, and it's been serious for decades. Like, I remember when I was growing up in the prairies, the city I lived in was a stronghold of this neo-Nazi group called the Aryan Guard, and they would assault and attack Muslim and Jewish people. They would firebomb people's houses. They would go to punk shows and get in knife fights with people. They would beat people up at the train stations. They would have huge rallies and the cops would protect their side against the counter protesters. So, yeah, it's getting really bad here, but it's also been bad for decades.
One of the big ironies about the convoy is that I've read the majority of actual long haul truckers are South Asian or recent South Asian immigrants or South Asian second generation South Asian workers, and so they're getting co-opted by this by this movement that's aggrieved by them being there, right?
The far right in the U.S. tried to piggyback on the Freedom Convoy. If I'm not mistaken, figures like Trump and Bannon like encouraged an American Freedom Convoy, but it didn't pan out the way it panned out in Canada. It didn't get anywhere near the same degree of press or tension. It just kind of fizzled. Is there something about the Canadian political scene, political culture, political situation, whatever it might be, that made it particularly susceptible to the convoy?
Yeah, I think this is a really good question. And yes, I think Canada is susceptible to something like the Freedom Convoy. One, because transportation infrastructure is a necessity here. So just for people that may not know that are listening in, Canada is the second largest country in the world geographically, but it has like 9 times less people than the United States. So what connects it is the railroads and the highway, the Trans-Canada Highway. And there's a lot of national and political mythology and symbolism tied to this transportation infrastructure, like the railroad and the highway. So interestingly, I think the Freedom Convoy actually really drew on national memory and imagery, consciously or not. The railroad is also like this symbol of national unity and progress to patriots. Meanwhile, it's the symbol of expropriation and colonial domination for Indigenous people. For Chinese people, the railroad represents exclusion and exploitation.
Trying to mainstream the right-wing ideology to make it, you know, more populist. Was there anything like that?
Yeah, that's why the imagery of the truckers has to be used. Like, if it's just a bunch of like right-wing politicians and people with connections to neo-Nazi gangs and paramilitary groups, that imagery is not very, we represent the country, we're the everyman imagery. The truckers' involvement and the use of the trucks and stuff like that, for sure, is what ties it to populism. One thing I want to say also, just to clarify, is like, so the Freedom Convoy drew on this popular imagery in Canada. That doesn't mean the Freedom Convoy was very popular. So Zach Beauchamp for Vox cited a study in one of the articles he wrote about the Freedom Convoy.
His name is pronounced Beauchamp.
Beauchamp.
Zach Beauchamp.
62% of Canadians were against the like mainstream messaging of it. So like the vaccine mandate messaging. I imagine there was even more than 62% of the population that was against the more outrageous and like overtly racist messaging, like the waving of Nazi flags and the these like calls to shoot healthcare workers who help people get vaccinated. I'm sure even more people were opposed to that. So that's a huge percentage of the population that was not on board with the Freedom Convoy, even though it garnered such massive attention from, I think, drawing on these national symbols.
Well, link to the Zach Beauchamp article from Vox.
The conservative leader at this time, his endorsement and engagement with the Freedom Convoy, it seemed to be a pretty notable thing from here, that this mainstream conservative leader was courting with this pretty fringe collection of populist extreme far right talking points, and he was courting them. But is courting the populist right, is that actually that unique for Canadian conservatives to do, or does it just appear so from our vantage point as Americans?
Right. Yeah, I guess just a brief note on Poilievre. Yeah, he became the leader of the Conservative Party on September 10th, 2022, so pretty recently. And he before that served in Stephen Harper's cabinet. So Stephen Harper was the last Conservative Prime Minister of Canada. He's the chairman of National Democratic Union, which is from my understanding, an organization that's trying to bring conservative parties around the world into closer collaboration. And this includes the Republican Party. It includes the Tories from the UK, et cetera. And it also, Stephen Harper has come out and said that like Viktor Orban is a great ally of Canada, et cetera. So it's, in my perspective, it's not that much of a departure. I think there was a rebranding in with the merger in the 2000s when the Conservative Party, the current iteration of the Conservative Party came into being. There was this idea in there, and I'm getting this from York University professor Laura J. Kwok, that the Conservative Party wanted to appear less racist to win elections, but their policies and their actual orientation didn't move that far.
Increasingly, Trudeau's liberals have begun comparing Poilievre to Trump very explicitly. They posted a video on Twitter directly comparing their behaviors. And this is, we should say to the listeners, is there's a good likelihood that there's an election. Well, they have to have one soon, but there could also be one sooner. And the Conservatives are doing very well in the polls. And so Trudeau's Liberal Party is responding by comparing Poilievre to Trump. And so is there a resistance to Trumpism in Canada enough that these comparisons to Trump are viewed as damaging to the Canadian Conservatives?
Yeah, I don't know if this has much rhetorical power. Like, I'm not sure if likening Poilievre to Trump will convince, I don't know if that would be the line, you know what I mean? The deciding factor, if someone was like, oh, I'm on the fence about this person. Oh, but he's like Trump. No, I can't do it because I'm so against Trump. I haven't seen that articulated. I haven't seen the resistance to white nationalism and authoritarianism in Canada recently be articulated as a resistance to Trumpism. And I mean, I guess I have heard some people call Poilievre, like, just not like the liberal, not Trudeau's liberals, but just people in everyday interactions being like, oh, he's like basically the Canadian Trump. But I don't know how damaging this rhetorical move actually is. It seems like this would have a big impact on people in my generation, but apparently people in my generation are actually, voter intention is showing that they're more likely than usual to vote for the Conservatives in the upcoming, in the 2025 elections, because Poilievre is talking about housing affordability. It doesn't seem like the comparison to Trump is dissuading people, because people are concerned that the liberals aren't addressing the things that they want to be addressed. And as one of my friends say, you could run an empty suit against Trudeau and win at this point. You see some left coverage of what people want, and there's a lot of the coverage is about austerity policies and stuff like that too, but I'm not sure that that's what people are actually concerned about. I'm just, that's what the left reports on, and they have their own reasons and motivations for reporting on that issue versus other ones.
Why it might be that they're focused on austerity when, you know, regular people might have broader concerns.
There's this debate that I've heard about in Canada, whether Poilievre actually believes any of this reactionary stuff he says, or any of the stuff that people that he associates with say, or if he's just using it, or if he's just like a crude opportunist that's trying to use the so-called culture wars to win the election or whatever. And I think this debate is kind of distracting. So let me explain a bit. Poilievre is not like a celebrity crank who's like just arrived in politics. Like I said, he was in Harper's cabinet. He was an activist in the Reformer Party. So I think to suggest that his white nationalism may be an accessory seems to suggest that white nationalism amongst Canadian conservatives more generally may be just an expression of opportunism and not be a pillar of their political project. And I think this implication is an expression of a common and grave underestimation of the role white nationalism plays in Canadian politics. some leftists are downplaying the significance of white nationalism by implying that austerity is the real problem and that political battles over democratic rights and freedoms that don't have to do with economic stability are part of the culture wars. I see this as basically accommodating white nationalism because it doesn't directly confront this reactionary conception that the conservatives have that freedom is supposed to be an exclusive privilege for white people or people who will assimilate into white dominated society without any complaints. And I think the left, I don't know why the left does this, but I think it's like a kind of economism where they're like, oh, well, all of this stuff about rights and freedoms is secondary. What really matters is the economy, because under capitalism, democracy isn't real anyways. But when they say the economy is primary, what they mean is not the relations of production. What they mean is the distribution policies. So I think they see that these distribution policies are primary and that the fight over rights and stuff like that is secondary, because you can't actually, it's this idea, I think it's this kind of black and white thinking that because democracy is constrained by capitalism, there's not really any reason to fight for democratic rights within capitalism. Thus, we just have to focus on the economy. But when they focus on the economy, they're only focusing on income redistribution. And I think this is all wrong. I don't think that the like austerity politics and the white nationalist politics exist in two separate categories and have nothing to do with each other. I think they go hand in hand. And I think that it has to do with this idea that freedom is an exclusive privilege. So when you take away, when you continue to erode the welfare state, you associate freedom with the freedom of capital to accumulate. And when you take away the democratic rights of minorities, you associate freedom with the white conception of Canadian identity. I think these things are happening in tandem, and the left just prioritizes one over top of the other. And I think it's a kind of modern day economism.
Yeah. I think, you know, it depends on what part of the left you're referring to when you say the left. But in MHI's prospectus for 2018, Resisting Trumpist Reaction, we quote Sam Gindin, who's a political economist in Canada. And he was basically saying, you know, like, be quiet about immigration because it's just not popular. You know, you got to meet people where they're at. And where people are at is not pro-immigration. And what we need to do is, you know, focus on these bread and butter issues. I mean, basically, for Gindin, the point is to try to, I think, tie the left towards the kind of line being promoted by the union bureaucrats. I think he was writing this in Jacobin, you know, which is essentially a U.S. publication. So it was kind of this attempt to say we're going to fight Trumpism by fighting neoliberalism, and we got to put all of our eggs in this anti-neoliberal basket. And it just totally failed to understand the real nature of the Trumpite threat, the white nationalism, the white supremacism, the misogyny, and the things that are really driving it, not economic hardship or, you know, workers being pummeled by neoliberalism. So there's a good deal of that, you know, this feeling among the left first kind of types that, well, the way we're going to be able to differentiate ourselves, you know, is not by promoting the freedom of, you know, this group or that group or the inclusiveness or, you know, a different concept of freedom in society. You know, we're going to have to fight these battles, you know, on economic issues, appeal to people where we're at and try to like gain adherents and followers by promoting basically an economic populist agenda. But the other thing I wanted to say was that this whole debate about whether Poilievre really believes what he's saying or not is really wrong-headed, because it doesn't matter what he really believes. Donald J. Trump has probably no beliefs other than, you know, I need to raise $500 million by tomorrow in cash. That's the one thing that he believes. So, you know, 8 years ago or so, when people were trotting out that line, the idea was, oh, okay, he's saying all this to gain an audience, to win an election, but he will pivot. Oh, he will pivot. We kept hearing he's going to pivot. The man was, you know, going to do a whirling dervish. It never happened, okay? And that's because it doesn't matter what he personally believes. You know, the politics are not being driven by the personal commitments and ideology of one leader. And that's what we've learned, you know, in the U.S. is that there's a real objective set of conditions underlying Trumpism, and it's not dependent on the beliefs of one person or another. What's made Trump so successful is he told his people, listen to the right-wing talk radio, what are people saying? And then he would repeat it. He'd go on to, you know, his rallies. He would repeat it. He would see what works and what doesn't. So he tuned his message to what people wanted to hear. So it doesn't matter what he personally believes. It doesn't matter what Poilievre personally believes or Harper personally believes.
Every time Trump would go up and brag about how proud he personally was of Operation Warp Speed and the vaccine and his base, which is the Trumpist base largely being anti-vax and conspiratorial, booing it, even though it's coming out of the mouth of their favorite boy. And he's pulled back on talking about Operation Warp Speed. He's pulled back on bragging about the vaccine that before he was proud of, because it was created under his view, his watch, because the base is beyond him. He's beholden to it now and has to try and meet them where they're at, because, you know, the Trumpist base has a mind and malignancy of its own.
Yeah, I completely agree 100% that this idea, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if he's a true believer or a crude opportunist, because there's momentum behind these views. And I think this is what I mean by it's this conversation in the first place about whether he believes these things or not is a huge underestimation of the role white nationalism has played in Canadian politics. It's not like it doesn't matter because white nationalism is a strain and a current and a tendency and an energy within Canadian national politics. And it will be there. It's been there before Poilievre was here, and it will be there after Poilievre was here. It'll be there until it's defeated. And so what we have to confront is not the personal motivations or like the psychological speculations we can make about Poilievre himself, but this tendency of white nationalism in Canadian politics, and this tendency in the left, the Canadian left, to say that white nationalism is not a primary thing to challenge and focus on, and that the struggle for democratic rights and freedoms against these white nationalists is secondary. Like, this is that, yeah, exactly. Totally what you guys are saying is what I'm trying to say about Canada, is that if we don't confront this white nationalism directly, it's not going to go away with Poilievre. It's not going to go away at any time, because it's fundamental to politics here. It's not being challenged by the non-Indigenous left, at least. I should qualify that. Indigenous people have always been the vanguard of challenging white nationalism in Canada, but the non-Indigenous left is really drags its feet on this question. And Andrew, you were talking about Gindin and meeting people where they're at and stuff. But I do think that a lot of the non-Indigenous, or like the socialist or the anti-neoliberal left, thinks that this battle over democracy and democratic rights and freedoms is a lost cause because workers are stupid and backwards or something, and that we just have to appeal to like working class, like base instincts or something like that, which I think is incredibly offensive.
I think we should make a little time in this conversation for the struggle for Indigenous dignity and rights in the past few years of Canadian politics and for the whole existence of Canadian politics. It's
that is a struggle for democracy, right? And I can't help but notice that both Trudeau and Poilievre have very little to say on that topic. So could you speak a little more to that?
Yeah, of course. We don't hear the struggle for national self-determination as much here as in other places or historically. You hear the struggle for Indigenous sovereignty. And the reason that it's articulated this way is because the Indigenous nation here has never gave up their land titles and or never gave up their territory, so that in their interpretation, they're still sovereign nations. And what they're fighting for is to retain and expand that sovereignty under the occupation of the Canadian state, rather than forming new nations or something like that in the collapse of an empire. But I do think it is a democratic struggle, because if the Canadian government was to recognize Indigenous nations as independent political entities, nations, it would be transformative for Canadian society. I mean, it would go down so deep as to change the nature of who controls land, who controls access to oceans and bodies of water and natural resources. It would go so far as to change the nature of how we produce, because Indigenous people have traditional modes of production that continue to exist, that are some of them are oppositional, some of them are kind of articulable with the capitalism, so these just fundamental questions about economics and politics would shift if the Indigenous sovereignty were recognized. It would be a hugely transformative for Canadian democracy. But I wanted to just mention the couple of struggles recently. I talked about Search the Landfill a bit earlier, but the two other big ones in my lifetime, at least, have been Idle No More, which started in 2012 by Nina Wilson, Sheila McLean, Sylvia McAdam, and Jessica Gordon. And it was a protest movement against the Canadian government's dismantling of environmental protection laws, which endangers Indigenous people. And then the other one is the Shut Down Canada movement, which started in 2020. After the RCMP invaded the Wet'suwet'en territory, and there was solidarity blockades across the entire country. One in particular that was very militant and durable was the Kanawage Mohawks on the Tyndanega Mohawk territory, which is on the other side of the country from the Wet'suwet'en territory. This mass movement was huge, and it really demonstrated what the actual relationship of Canada to Indigenous nations is, when all of the nice talk about reconciliation and recognition is dropped. So the RCMP invaded this nation's territory, evicted a bunch of people off their own land to push through a pipeline. And so that's what's happened. That's Canada right there, when the makeup is off or whatever. And that's what's lingering behind all this talk of reconciliation, is if you don't find a way to peacefully coexist with Canada, we're going to invade your territory, we're going to rip you out of there, and we're going to do what we want anyways. Leading up into the 2015 federal election, Trudeau made this promise to renew nation-to-nation relationship between Canada and Indigenous people, and it quickly became evident that he wasn't going to come through on this promise of renewing nation-to-nation leadership. So Pamela Palmetter, Mi'kmaq lawyer, she has this book called Warrior Life, where the first section of it, a lot of the articles talk about Trudeau's promise to renew this nation-to-nation relationship, and how he didn't do it, and how in the budget after they won the election, there wasn't even money to do it. So it was all kind of fluff. And so Indigenous people rightfully feel incredibly betrayed by this, and I think this betrayal is super significant because it makes one, everything Trudeau now says about Canada's policy towards Indigenous nations hard to believe, but two, it everything he says now is still couched in this same colonial relation where Indigenous people are not are conceived of as their own independent nations, but are conceived as to belonging to Canada as like a special interest group or like a so-called visible minority of Canada rather than their own peoples and nations. And then so any promise from that framework is a not meeting the standards of the past promise he made. So this reneging on that promise really, I think, fractious for Indigenous relations with the Liberal Party.
Can you say more on what Poilievre is saying in regards to Canadian policy towards Indigenous nations?
Yeah, definitely. So from what I understand, Poilievre is talking about what he calls economic reconciliation, which I think is code for in integrating Indigenous people into capitalist production processes. So this, of course, would mean more land expropriations, more dispossession and displacement of Indigenous people into the towns and cities where they're separated from families, discriminated against and have a hard time finding work, and where they're assaulted, raped, and murdered by non-Indigenous people or thrown in jail disproportionately by the cops. It also, this economic reconciliation talk, I think also means more financial and political backing for the factions in the Indigenous movement that are willing to cut deals with the government, sign over land titles, prioritize the development of industry over top of services for the community, et cetera. And so I think this so-called economic reconciliation would actually sharpen class lines within Indigenous nations and encourage the development or further development of neo-colonial structures and institutions. And I think it's worth saying that this term reconciliation in Canada is always kind of a code. So what it appears to mean is an apology from Canada for the legacy and ongoing colonialism and a rebuilding of trust with Indigenous nations who have been harmed by Canadians' colonial policies for the last however many hundred years. But underneath this appearance of reconciliation is actually just a shift in Dene scholar and activist Glenn Coulthard's words. This reconciliation is not ushering in an era of peaceful coexistence grounded on the ideal of reciprocity and mutual recognition. Instead, I would say that it's just a shift from exterminationist policy to an assimilationist policy. And the assimilationist policy is trying to erode Indigenous nationhood. It's just trying to integrate Indigenous people into Canada and integrate Indigenous nations into the Canadian state and integrate Indigenous people into the capitalist production process. So this reconciliation, whether it's the typical reconciliation that's been floated around by all parties in Canada for years, or this new economic reconciliation that Poilievre is talking about, it's not really about dignity and rights for Indigenous people. It's actually just about taking the land over. It's a continued policy of taking the land. And
you reconcile yourself to our rule.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. And another thing, like, so you hear this, you hear economic reconciliation, you hear this idea of self-government, self-reliance. Poilievre said hard work and self-reliance are the keys to Indigenous success, but this is also just code, and it means he wants to stop giving Indigenous nations and people economic support. So it's all this fancy, nice language that looks like white people care about Indigenous people, but it's all lies, and it's just new packaging on the same colonial policies.
Thank you so much for joining us, Teresa, and for enlightening us and for answering questions based on a lot of ignorance.
Thank you for coming on the show, Teresa, and I would say come on again, but I'm sure we'll have you on again, and we're looking forward to it.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm glad to be able to be on the show again. And I'm glad to try to field questions from people that don't know much about Canada, because it really pushed me to take a deeper look and to try to research some of these things that I've neglected. It was enlightening for me too.
You've been listening to Teresa Henry speaking with Gabriel Donnelly and me about the political situation in Canada. Please visit MHI's website, MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, to listen to other episodes, to learn more about the issues we discuss, to post comments, and to donate to this podcast series. Let me announce again that MHI will be holding Zoom meetings on the state of the UK economy on April 7, and on interpretation on April 21, both at 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time in the U.S., 6 to 8 p.m. British Summer Time. They're open to the public. If you'd like to attend, please write to MHI and ask to be invited. This has been episode 114 of Radio Free Humanity, the Marxist Humanist Podcast, coming to you from deep within capitalist society. Thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.